Oh, yeah, we're back. Yes, baby, like Slim Shady, we're back again. It's Thursday. Jules, what's going on?
Hi, Gab. It's good to be back, especially after the last few days we've had with the mess in France. You know, some of the stories coming from the UK as well. Germany, big meeting today, Premier League tomorrow, all of that. It's going to be a busy show.
We're going to get into all that. We're also going to be joined by Thor Christian Carlsen, who, of course, compiled for the website his list of the 36 best talents aged under 21. And by the way, to our friends north of the border in Canada, I'm pleased to say, did you notice there's twice as many Canadians as there are Mexicans and Americans combined on his list?
Yeah, and Liverpool have the TAA. We've got TKK, ESPN. And to be fair, he's done a really good job because it might look easy like this, but it was a hell of a job to just go down to 36 players because the list is pretty impressive.
We're going to have the Alphabet 11. We're going to have quick hits, all your favorite. I want to share with you my artifact for the day, which I found here, which is a ticket to the 2009 nice. Confederations Cup semifinal at Ellis Park in Joburg. I have to say, I didn't remember who played in this game. The other semifinal that day was Spain against the United States. Do you remember who won that one?
Spain 4-0?
No, the United States actually beat Spain in that game. I think it might have been 2-0. It was like the first. It was Spain were in the midst of their incredible run. I was at that game, too. I actually drove like 4 hours through the night from Bloemfontein to Joburg. Anyway, we digress. So let's move on to the less happy times we live in. Ligue 1. No more.
Rien ne va plus. Rien du tout. Nothing. Nada. It was a big shock, Gab, on Tuesday afternoon. Since the morning, we were briefed that the Prime Minister, Edouard Philippe, was going to announce there would be no football until August, but we still thought that maybe some games could be played in August. But before Tuesday, we never really thought that would happen. It was a big shock. It was probably the right decision because the government said it was not safe enough for the players to return and football to resume, which I can completely understand. But I was disappointed and I was sad, like all football fans and people in France. Mixed reaction from players. Well, I was going to say mixed. Not really mixed. A lot of the players that I spoke to or spoke publicly, there was a great interview from Dante in L'Equipe, for example, the Nice captain, who's saying like, this was absolutely the right decision. We would have looked like clowns had we going back to training and playing when the rest of the country was still pretty much in lockdown and when you still had people contracting the virus, dying from the virus and etc. So clearly a lot of the football players in France were actually quite happy that the league was not resuming in June and training in May. So I guess it was the right decision, but it's a tricky one now in what do you do next. Well, financially, the big losses for clubs.
I want to ask about that, and I'm also going to tie it with what's happening elsewhere in the Bundesliga and, of course, the Premier League. But we hear all these doomsday scenarios about the TV money. Now, there's reports that Paris Saint-Germain are going to end up losing out on $200 million. I think a lot of these figures are sort of finger in the air type figures, but it's been confirmed that they're not going to get that final installment that they didn't get it before. Now they're never getting that final installment of TV money back from Canal Plus, right? I think it was Canal Plus, right? Who was the
Canal Plus and beIN Sports? Yeah, and beIN Sports, announced no games. We're not going to pay for games that we're not going to broadcast. So that's 250 million euros that would have obviously divided by all the clubs would have taken some of that money. But yeah, that's still a big chunk that you're missing out.
And so between that and obviously they're going to lose out on gate receipts as well. And I mean, is this how dire is the situation really in the sense that, as I understand it, in France, they have pretty strict rules in terms of the way clubs are run, almost like their own version of financial fair play. You have to have X amount of cash in the bank if you want to compete. Is it as dramatic as, you know, people saying clubs are going to go bust, so PSG will have to sell everybody or not?
So it depends who you're listening to. There's some presidents and owners who've said, you know what, we all should be in an okay position now, next season, because we know that season will happen. There's a new TV right deal that kicks in with Media Pro coming in that is over 1 billion euros. So clubs would have more money next season than they would have had ever before. And some clubs are saying, you know what, why don't we get an advance on that? If that's okay, we could do that. We could find a way of not going bust right now. For some clubs, it's more difficult. Marseille posted 90 million euros losses last year. So for them, it's dramatic. But again, they will qualify for the Champions League for next season. So they will have far more money next season. So you could find a way, I think, for clubs to be okay for now. But the season has to start again in late August or September behind closed doors even, but something like that. So I don't think it's as dramatic as maybe some make out it is. But it's still obviously financially a huge loss and quite a tough one to take on.
How are they going to resolve issues in terms of awarding the title, relegation? I mean, obviously on Monday we had our new buddy JJ van Hanegem on from Fox Sports in Holland. That looks like a big cluster mess. Is it going to get messy? Are people going to reach an understanding? Obviously, at the top, Paris Saint-Germain had a big lead. Does it look like they'll be getting the title?
So it's interesting because on Tuesday night, so on the same day as the announcements was made, Noël Legret, the head of the French FA, not the French league, the French FA, but the French FA supersedes the league. He said, I'm the boss here and I'm going to decide. The regulation says that if a season stops at some point, you take the last table that you have available and you decide everything from there.
So the regulations actually say this in France.
He said this in France. He gave an interview in a local newspaper in Bretagne, where he said, this is exactly what's going to happen. I'm telling you, we could have meetings, we could have a vote, but this is the rules, this is the regulations. PSG, they're top, they're champions. Second Marseille, sorry, third Rennes, going to Champions League, and blah, blah, blah. He kept going on.
Somebody actually checked, and he wasn't just making this up. They actually had regulations beforehand, before the league started, that says if the league is abandoned, the champion will be the one, whoever has the most points when the league stops.
Yeah, so that was the case on Tuesday night.
Then,
on
and by Wednesday, the way, let's be clear: this is not the case in England and elsewhere. In England, you know, like it's pretty extraordinary because I'm guessing after this experience, every single league is going to put whatever mechanism they choose into the regulations beforehand. Because if it's there, it seems to be pretty ironclad. If this is what the regulations say, then this becomes law, right?
True. Although there's still a case and an argument for saying, "Hang on a minute," And that's if you were owning a club and I was owning a club in France, that's why you would say, hang on a minute, I could still keep my team up because we had 9 games left to go. We don't have to play PSG, but the team that is just a point above us will have to play PSG. So, you know, they would have lost.
Yeah, I get that. But the regulations were there when the season started. So,
yeah, but that doesn't prevent people from arguing that if you play the remaining games, the table is different. So Lille and Lyon, for example, have come up and said, hang on a minute. We've checked all the last seasons. And in the last quarter of a season, you've got 40% chances of the table moving everywhere and teams that are outside of Europe going into Europe and all of that. So everybody's making their case, right? You try your best.
That's what the rules say. But I'm sorry. If you want to make that case beforehand. Once the rules are there, and the rules were there at the start of the season, how about you shut the hell up and go away and just deal with the fact that you agreed to play in a league where those were the rules at the start of the season.
And you're absolutely right. But you will still have people to say, but this is unfair. Jean-Michel Aulas, right now his team, Lyon, because they had such a bad season from start to when he finished outside of Europe, which is a disaster for him. So he goes, hang on, let me find a way. Oh yeah, we could have a playoff, 3 phases playoff, where the top 7 teams could actually have a playoff to win the league. He's not even saying, okay, PSG wins the league and then we do a playoff for the European places. No, he said we do a playoff, top 7 teams can have a playoff and can win the league.
What, in September? Then,
Yeah, or end of August, he said, maybe, who knows, maybe we can squeeze some games in August. But listen to this, Lyon are closer to the fight for the relegation than they are for the fight for the Champions League. So if you do a playoff, Jean-Michel Aulas, your team will have to be in the playoff not to go down more than to win the league. But, you know, it's one of those where everybody is trying to fight his corner. And it will get messy, of course, and you will have low suit. There's already teams in the second division, third division, say, hang on, we should have gone up. And we didn't need to go down and this and that. So it will get messed up.
But is the thinking, if based on the regulations, if Legret wins, then you will have teams that are being promoted, yeah? Is that clear-cut, the top promotion and the relegation?
Yeah, and top and the two that bottom two from the top division going down.
Wow. All right. So I don't want to use the infection analogy, but there is
Let me ask you something now. And do you think that this example and what happened in France, and we know already that President Macron have been calling, you know, people in Germany and in England and in Spain.
Do we know this?
Yeah. Saying like, hey, what do we...
Because this was reported in Le Parisien. Macron now, who I would imagine has more important things to do, has now started calling up other countries and saying, hey, you guys should shut down the football too, because that's what we've done.
Yeah, and the head of the sports federation, Roxana Maricinianu, doing the same and calling her counterpart.
How about they mind their own business? Yeah,
I know. I agree with you. I don't know what it's about. I don't even know.
What do they care?
I don't think they can even explain themselves why they're doing this. If it's just unity, if it's like it's too risky then for everyone around you, I don't know.
Well, it's funny with this unity argument because we both live in England. We're not English. You know how well this country in England like it, how much they like it when they get instructions from France or Germany on what to do. So let's not go down that route. But
Do you think other leagues could follow that or not?
I mean, I think that realistically they will. I don't think it's going to be Macron's phone call that convinces them to do it. But obviously, like we said on Monday, today, Thursday, would be a huge test case because today is the day that Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, she's meeting with the prime ministers of all the German regions. Germany has a federal system. It's not all centralized like France. And they're going to make a decision, or they were going to make a decision. The latest is that they might not make an announcement today, that we might not get a decision today, which it could be moved to next week. If it's moved to next week, I don't see how they can start playing on May 9th, frankly, the way it was originally suggested, because, you know, it takes time to set this up. I think everybody is watching. This really is all eyes on Germany, because if they can do it, if they can do it safely, there's hope for others. If not even Germany can do it, I think it's going to look really, really grim. In Spain, Tebas keeps talking about how they have to keep going. But, you know, that guy like starts talking the minute he wakes up in the morning and then keeps talking in his sleep all night. So in Italy, there's a curious situation where it's kind of the opposite, actually, what we're getting from mainland Europe to what we're getting in England, because it seems to me that in Spain and Italy and in France as well, there were, you know, the leagues wanted to keep playing, right? And it was the government who was saying, no, wait, the conditions, blah, blah, blah. They're kind of putting their handbrakes on. Here in England, and this has been reported over the last couple of days, the government is like, oh, yes, everybody go play and lift the nation's morale. But you're getting the sense that a number of clubs and especially a number of players, we had reporting from Alex Shaw yesterday on our website, they're saying, whoa, hang on a minute. I'm not sure I want to play again. I'm not convinced that things are safe.
It's not so early.
Yeah, I mean, I think clubs also don't want to be hung out to dry. Clubs don't, you know, the relationship between clubs and the government isn't great right now, because remember, the government took them to task when they weren't getting pay cuts and stuff like that. And they are, you know, it's very easy to criticize Premier League footballers and clubs because so many of them are millionaires or multimillionaires. But there's a big meeting on Friday where they're going to outline plans. But are you getting the sense that the wind is shifting a little bit here?
I feel like this, and after Alex Shaw published that piece on the website, I had a few texts as well from players saying, you know, it's really early going back to training in May, even playing early June. That's roughly a month ago. And they say, surely, when you see how the pandemic still is in this country, when you have fears of a second wave coming at some point when lockdown is eased or even finished, players are like, I don't want to put my health at risk. I don't want to put my family's health at risk. Okay, we could go and be in confinement for 6 weeks somewhere in the Midlands and play, but this is crazy as well. And you can come up with all the plans that you want. And we've said it from the beginning. Every listener will know. We've always said that it would be a government decision. But it seems that in England, the government is pushing. And like every other government in Europe, that in England, they're pushing and pushing and pushing for football to restart. Okay, fair enough. But let's not forget that the players are the one who's going to play, not Boris Johnson or not whoever else in the government.
I think one of the big issues for a lot of players, especially some of the foreign players, but some of the English ones. In fact, I was texting with a Premier League player who happens to be English, and on Wednesday, and he made the point that, look, we've had so many conflicting pieces of information coming from the Premier League, coming from the authorities, he's like, some clubs have told players, oh, come back and be ready to train on this day. Some clubs are already training individually. There's no protocol yet. This is the other thing which really blows my mind.
There's nothing in place.
Now, when we say protocol, for those who don't get it, we mean a plan for how they're going to keep the players safe, how they're going to test them, who's going to be allowed in the stadium, and so on. We've had extremely detailed protocols in Italy, in Spain, in Germany. I don't know if France got to that point yet or not, but and those have been analyzed and debated by the government, saying, well, you need this, you need that. Here in England, we don't even have that. You know, today, the news story, somebody spoke to the law enforcement saying, yeah, they should play in neutral venues. Because, of course, neutral venues are magically safe. There were others who referred the plan in the Midlands. We heard the St. George's Park. Report the other day, go play at Twickenham, which is a national rugby stadium. This is so, like, it's just such a mess. How can you not even have a plan? If you have a plan, at least, of how you're going to do this, then you can debate the plan, you can refine the plan, you can change the plan. But I don't blame the players for saying this is a freaking shambles. This is really, really bad from the Premier League. They don't have an idea. Now we had clubs saying, because this whole thing about only certain venues are going to be approved, okay, that's a great idea. But now clubs are saying, well, hang on a minute. If you're going to approve, say, White Hart Lane, which incidentally I'm not sure they can approve because it's being used for emergency services and stuff like that, but not, say, the London Stadium, then we don't have home games and Spurs have more away games. How do we get to this?
I don't know. And the players, they're your asset. They're your main asset. And surely, right now, if you want them to go back playing, you need to reassure them. You need to put your arm around them and say, okay, listen, this is unprecedented. You know, this virus is incredible. This is incredible. But this is what we're going to do. And you'll be fine. You'll be safe. Your family will be safe because we've got this step and this step and this step. And you're going to do this and you're going to be tested and you're going to have this. And we're going to... And instead, they're saying players are reading or hearing or people are letting them know, yeah, you're going to go back playing on June the 8th. All right. But we don't know how, where, with what, if you're going to get tested, what happens if someone is positive, by the way, do you stop the whole league? Do you keep playing? And the players are like, oh, like you said, this is a shambles. And the thing to do is to reassure them by putting that protocol together as soon as possible and say, we've got this. We've got your back. We've got this. Follow those steps and you'll be absolutely fine. And so will be your family. Instead, we're saying like, oh, yeah, you're going to be the guinea pigs again. Go out and play and we'll see what happens. This is stupid.
So they're meeting on Friday. Apparently they meet every 2 weeks, which I find absolutely shocking that the 20 clubs, I mean, they speak to each other offline, that they have these bi-weekly meetings. And I'm like, this is a time of crisis. This is your business at stake. Are you actually trying to get this done? I don't know.
But again, remember the other day when we said that they could not hear each other, you could not speak. Pep and Mourinho were on the line. They could not hear anything. No one asked them what they thought. The thing from the beginning has been a complete shambles.
I have to say, like, increasingly, and I appreciate they're under pressure, whatever, but the way the Premier League has handled this thus far, I don't want to go back because if Richard Scudamore were still around, this wouldn't have happened. But this is basically a freak show so far, and it's on them. It's on them, the 30% that they tried to negotiate early on, which blew up in their faces, the lack of planning. It's been, you know, and they always hide behind the same thing. Well, we're following government scientific advice. I'm like, yeah, that's fine. Government's giving advice every day. You're not following anything because you're not putting any kind of plan in place that you can at least debate. You don't have any contingencies. You don't have any scenarios. You're not even getting started. Everything started on the whole June 30th issue. But more broadly, Jose, I want to ask you, if we do get to the point, and I think my wish is that everybody plays and they can play safely.
Yeah.
But if we do get to that point, is there a chance that – does this automatically mean that the Champions League is out the window too? Or is there a scenario where maybe – might not be in August, might possibly push it forward to July, that maybe you can play some games and you can finish the Champions League because that is a totally different scenario and kettle of fish?
God, I think I can just imagine what UEFA must have felt like when they were told that the French Prime Minister will announce that there was no football in France until September. That was the worst nightmare for them, in a way. It will depend what other leagues do. I guess the Champions League, if you're home behind closed doors, or if you're away in another stadium, also behind closed doors in another country, like PSG will have to play the quarterfinals. It doesn't make much of a difference, I guess. You could put that argument forward. And I think for those top clubs, the Champions League is really the priority. I think if you said to them, okay, you can choose between the Champions League for the ones who are still in it, I mean, or play a few more of your domestic leagues, I think a lot of them said, you know what, let's focus on two more Champions League matches, four more, maybe five if you go all the way, if you're already in the quarterfinals. And that's much easier to deal with, I think, because you could find a better way than if you think about your domestic league. But I just think it's such a mess now everywhere, in every country, every league, every competition, that, I mean, good luck to every one of them who's trying to sort it out.
I mean, I think there is a scenario. I'm going to do some more reporting on this. Obviously, you know, UEFA want to put all the clubs first, all the leagues first. They've made it very, very clear. But I could envision a scenario where, and it wouldn't need to be in August, maybe it'll be mid-July or something, or early July, where they say, okay, what if, there's a big if the big five leagues, if most or all the teams still involved in Europe can't play, that maybe they look at something and they say, right, in what countries isn't there a blanket ban? Is there a way to safely go to, you know, Denmark, or safely go to possibly Germany? Maybe they can't play the whole league in Germany, but maybe in July, maybe you can play some games in specific stadiums. And maybe we bring the teams there and we quarantine the players, and maybe we finish this with some sort of different format. Or maybe go to Belarus, since obviously there's no issue there. I don't know. I think that is a possibility that, however remote, still remains on the table. I'm hoping we at least get something, but obviously the priority has to be safety. But I think what's very clear is that certainly, as far as England is concerned, the Premier League really has not covered themselves in glory. And we sit and wait and hope in Angela Merkel's view. And Jules, as promised, here he is. He materializes. Welcome, Tor Christian Carlsen. Tor, I don't know, when we introduced you, right, you've been a scout for a long time. You've worn different hats. You were a director of football at Monaco and elsewhere. So ESPN asked you to make a list of players under the age of 21. It's supposed to be a list of 30 players. And of course, in typical Norwegian fashion, you over-delivered. You gave us a list of many more than 30 players, right?
I started off with a short list of about 75 players. And then I trimmed it down to 50. And then it started to get really difficult, I have to say. But I managed to get it down to 30. And then I had to start adding on again. So it ended up with 36, which is a bit of an odd number, but I felt at 36 there was kind of a natural gap between 36 and 37. And now, after having spoken with you last night, you know, I kind of lost my night's sleep over 37, because I think there might be one there.
Yes. Kind of, I know. We'll get to that, because there's one guy who should
yes.
be on
the list. Gap was not happy.
I've noticed on this list there are twice as many Canadian players in the list as there are American players. Since we're friends north of the border, is the future for Canada better than the future for the U.S., given that you've got Jonathan David and Alphonso Davies? Can you talk to us about these two guys and why they're on the list?
Jonathan David, I think, is a bit of a wild card. He broke through, I think, two years ago. He came directly from North America. I think Gent had an idea of, playing him in the academy and then gradually, having him come through the first team. But I also think he's developed his game a lot over the last season. He was initially more of a counter-attacking player because he's pacey and he works very, very hard. But now I think he's better in also holding up the ball and playing 1-2s and that kind of thing. But mainly what I like very much of him is taking up the right spaces in the penalty area. He seems to have a very good knack for.
And Alfonso Davies, you love his reinvention as a left-back, yeah?
Yeah, I do. Although he's obviously a bit sort of, how to put it, he does make mistakes, but he's so quick that, if he makes a mistake high up the pitch, he can just chase it down again and recover the ball. But what an athlete as well. And that's obviously what strike your eye first with him. His athleticism, I don't know what kind of a dash he can make on a 60-meter or 100-meter, but it's quite extraordinary.
Martin Odegaard is not in your top 10. Is it because you didn't want to be...
You have two Norwegians.
You're Norwegian. That's why you put two Norwegians in the top 10. Yes. Because he's having a great season. And after everything that happened since he was so young and the move to Spain and et cetera, and you know him well and you know his family well and everything, he surely could have, he was quite close to your top 10, right, with the season he's having right now.
If you look at the players that dropped out of the 30, I think maybe Ødegaard could have been one that even didn't make the 30.
What?
Yeah.
Why?
Obviously, he's very, very good when he gets on the ball, and he's got that ability to spot things. He can play off one touch through balls. Obviously, he's got an amazing footballing brain. But I think if you want to go beyond that and become a regular at Real Madrid, you also need to. You can't just play in flashes or bursts, and I feel that. There's got to be a little bit more of Martin Ødegaard working off the ball, doing a bit of the dirty work as well. And I think now he's just 75% of what you recognize in his play is basically the good things. And sometimes there are too long breaks between the good things, although those good things are really, really good.
Fede Valverde at number 9, I don't think anybody's going to argue with that. Although I do think he probably looks a little bit better because the players around him are so good, but got so much personality. I want to ask about Jean-Felix because his CV wasn't very long when he moved for all that money in the summer. And, a lot of us sort of nodded knowingly and says, well, he looks really pretty when he plays. But, Mendes, Atleti, the usual gang. If you were the director of football of Atletico Madrid and Jorge Mendes wasn't a factor, would you have spent this much money on him based on what you saw?
I certainly would have taken him, as you know as well as I do. Portuguese football is a completely different place to be than in, Atletico Madrid in particular, and indeed Spanish football, which is a lot more competitive. I felt, based on what he's done at Atletico Madrid, I don't think maybe he deserves the top 10. So there is maybe possibly. I've looked more at the price there and the potential and even the visual aspect because it's so fantastic to watch him play.
So easy on the eye. Inevitably, these lists are skewed towards more attacking players, which I don't really have a problem with. And I include Alexander Arnold in that because you can say he plays right back, but he's more attacking than most players. There's true primarily defensive guys on this list. One is Donnarumma, who's in seventh place. I don't have an issue with him. The guy's nearly 200 games starting in Serie A. That's fine. I'm curious to get your view on Matthijs de Ligt because I'm fascinated by him because in general with central defenders, when we see central defenders who are playing at a very high level at a very young age, first of all, it's very rare. Second of all, they tend to be phenomenal athletes first and foremost. De Ligt, I think it's fair to say, is a very good athlete, but he's not a physical freak. He's a tall guy. but he's good on the ball. He reads the game. He's got a lot of qualities that a veteran central defender generally has. Can you just talk a little bit about him and why it's so unusual to have a central defender who's so young making an impact like this?
Yeah, that was one of the dilemmas while compiling the list. I mean, I think there's four defenders. And obviously two of those are fullbacks. You mentioned Trent Alexander-Arnold, and then there's Hakimi, who's also more or less a winger.
Yeah.
And Saka is in there as well, who's also, you know, converted winger. For centre-backs, I mean, throughout the years, I've also found that, you know, those that tend to dominate at under-17 World Championships, under-20 World Championships, even they, many of them just fail to make the grade. And it's predominantly the forward, the attacking players. Even there's a fair few defensive midfielders in there. We can get back to that later. But I think it's got to do with, you know, being a centre-back, it's got so much to do with the understanding, the reading of the game, and experience, positioning, and mental qualities rather than just the physical. Obviously, young players, they like to express themselves and kind of do what they like, which is more suitable in attack than as a centre-back. And obviously, I also think clubs are less keen on giving opportunities to young centre-backs because you will make mistakes and that might also affect them mentally, which might mean that they just end up on the bench and not having nurtured them the right way and, you know, fast-tracking centre-backs, it might backfire on you. But interestingly, I also had, I don't know what the French are doing at the moment because I had so many French centre-backs. There was Camara at OM. There was Saliba, I think, is on loan.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Etienne, Paradou, yeah. There's Koudé at Sevilla. There's Todibo as well at Schalke. So there's just so many of them. But contrary, Upamecano is obviously made a fantastic mark. I think at the age of 16, 17, he was already, you know, played at Valenciennes in the first team. But to answer your question, Gabriele, I think it is mainly to do with the understanding of the game and also that clubs are maybe more adverse to giving them a chance early on.
Erling Haaland is eighth on your list, TK. Is that a reflection of giving maybe a bit more time for him at Dortmund and playing in a more competitive league than he did in Austria before?
Yeah. Obviously, you can't knock what he's done up to now. It's quite remarkable. Top scorer of the Champions League. I think he's got 9 in 5 starts for Dortmund. Ironically, sometimes with players, they have to stop scoring to kind of understand what they can do. Because if they just keep scoring and scoring, you just focus on the scoring and they seem to be on a run. And you see less of their overall game. So you just kind of want Haaland to settle down and to understand what his kind of core game is all about. I don't quite understand that. There's some sides of his game that needs improving. I think his heading, I haven't seen him score from a header yet, I don't think.
He probably did in Salzburg, but we'd never noticed because we don't watch the Austrian league.
I'm not sure.
He must have scored a header in his career.
Well, I can't remember having seen one.
Okay, Austrian Bundesliga fans, this man scored like 70 goals in 10 games. If you can provide video of Haaland scoring with his head, I'll be even more grateful. All right, but let's look at the top of the list, shall we? Jules, I'm assuming you're not going to argue with the guy he has at number one.
No, I think Kylian Mbappe being top of your list, TK, I obviously completely agree. It was more when you left Monaco in 2013, I think he just signed as a 15-year-old. So obviously your path crossed. But I knew that at the time you already heard about the talent that he had and that all the clubs wanted him. But what makes him so special for you? And I guess you're not surprised by how incredible so far his career has been.
You know, I was also tasked with obviously mentioning the strengths of the players and how they can improve. I find it very, very hard to come up with something. How could Mbappe improve without trading off something that would make him a weaker player, you know? And I think, you know, he's world champion and he's obviously proven himself time and time again. Such a natural footballer to me, you know, instinctively. Not just the physical side, which obviously gets a lot of attention, you know, his pace and one against one ability. But I just think the way he looks for the right spaces, the way he... And also his perception, the way that he, you know, his head always moves. He knows what he's doing before he picks up the ball. I find it quite, you know, amazing that a player at this age can be so sophisticated in the way he plays the game, basically.
I have no real argument with number two or number three, Jadon Sancho and Trent Alexander-Arnold. Number four, you have Vinicius Jr., who's out of the Real Madrid lineup for a big chunk of time this year.
I have to admit, Gabriela, that it was a struggle to... The top three for me was quite easy. And I also think that the top 10, the names, when compiling such lists as these, personal preference comes into the picture here. And in the case of Vinicius Jr., I just love his... I love the way that, you know, whenever he comes on, he makes things happen. Also, again, the movement of the ball, I think, is terrific. You could play him at left back if you wanted to. You know, he can play, obviously, now he plays further up the field. But I just like the explosive nature of his game.
Kai Havertz is fifth on your list. He's been playing for Bayer Leverkusen for a number of years now. He was having a great season until the season stopped. Mm. Do you think he can step up to even the next level if he moves to a bigger club like Bayern, for example, or even to the Premier League? And also, what's his best position? Because we've seen him playing as the fourth number nine this year, which was quite exciting to see. Mm. He can play a bit deeper. I think he's got so many qualities. Where do you think he would be best?
I haven't really seen a similar player. It's such a weird kind of... The whole makeup, he's quite lanky. He's he can look a bit, you know, lazy, and then he just goes past the opponent. He's not exactly a number 10. He's not exactly a wide player. Maybe his future is as number 8 in a midfield of 3. Yeah. But I just think he's a wonderful player to watch as well. I know that shouldn't, you know, maybe the aesthetical aspect shouldn't be so... important here, but I just think
this is toward the romantic speaking. All right, let's talk about the people who are missing from this list. I'm going to go first. Jules, you can point this out. Reece James, come on. How can you not have... You've shown your disdain for defensive players to begin with, but you don't have Reece James in this list. Why? What does he have to do to convince you?
I think... What he has to do, first of all, is to play more games for Chelsea. I think he started 12 in the Premier League.
And before that... He did the full season in League One last year. It's not like Chelsea's the only team in the world.
Well, but there wouldn't be other League One players in there.
He's a starter for a team in the top four. A lot of these jokers on here aren't even in the top four. He's in the top four of the freaking Premier League. Come on, man.
I do agree with you that he's a good defender. And that becomes... For a fullback, it's a little bit of a novelty these days, whereas fullbacks are mainly judged on what they do further up the pitch, which admittedly has been given more of an importance here.
All right, the list is the top players under the age of 21 or who turned, I guess, 22 on May 1st. It's up on our website. Check it out. Let us know what you think. Direct all complaints at Mr. Tor Christian Carlson, not Jules and I. We're just, don't shoot the messenger, basically. All right, Jules, let's cheer ourselves up with our Alphabet 11. It's the L team.
The L team, and you could have me as a goalkeeper, as a manager, as a number 10, as a striker. I can play everywhere. I'm that good. Disappointingly, no one has put me in their team. I've had a few teams where I was the manager. I was quite happy with that. Obviously, I think this has to be the letter with the most options, names, possibilities that you could do. So before we hear yours, Gab, and we've got Miguel on an all women 11 as well. Let me give you a few. So just, I'm going to start with something. If you put Jesse Lingard in your team, this is a no. This is a big no. This is
I did not put no. Jesse Lingard in my team.
No. So I'm not going to read out any of the teams who have Jesse Lingard, no offense, in their team. But some interesting ones. We've had Casey, for example, who put Roger Lemaire, good old Roger Lemaire, as his manager. And he's got a 4-2-3-1. Interesting, with Lloris in goal, Lazzari, Langlais, Laporte and Lodi at the back, Locatelli and Lehmer in midfield, Lehmer, Lo Celso, Lozano, and then Lukaku up front.
Alan Ooh, Robbins, Manuel Locatelli.
Manuel Locatelli. Alan Robbins went a really, really long way, and that's why I picked his team. He has Lars Sonner from Brest in front in goal, Lala from Strasbourg at right back, Leisner from Köln, and Laporte at centre back, Lucas from Spartak at left back. He's got Luis from Benfica in midfield, Lis Melou from Nice, Lawson from Emmen, Labiad from Ajax, Linzen from Vitesse, and Lewandowski up front.
Wait, from Ajax too?
Yeah. Well, I thought it was...
Labiad,
yeah. Which I thought, a young player.
I know. It's just the way you pronounce it reminded me of something else. But go on.
All right. Okay. Franklin has Anthony Lopez from Lyon in goal, Langlais, Laporte, David Luiz, Lucas and Sean Longstaff in midfield, Lozano, Lema, Lanzini, Lewandowski and Luke Bacchio.
You can do that. Why just the one Longstaff? Why not both of them?
I guess he doesn't really fancy the other one. Aaron Pires has Lloris in goal, Lundstrom. You need a Sheffield United player in your team. Laporte, Langlais, Luiz, Llorente, Lo Celso, Lema, Lacazette, Lewandowski and Lozano. So interesting one. Our friend eBest16 has a low and order team. Ooh. So Ian Lawler in goal from Doncaster, Alex Lawless from Ebbsfleet, James Lawrence from St. Pauli, Josh Law from Basford United in the non-league football, Kemar Lawrence from Anderlecht, Nicky Law from Exeter, Rawez Lowen from Dalkurd, I believe in Sweden, Conor Lawless from Reading, Stephen Lawless from Livingston, James Lawry from a non-league Nantwich, and Tom Lawrence from Derby. Well done on the
Lawrence. How impressive is that?
Very, very impressive.
Mad props to him.
Yes.
By the way, you know, like, if they actually played, you know who'd be covering the game?
No.
Well, it would be our colleagues, Matt Law.
Yes, good one.
Matt Lawton from The Times, Matt Law, of course, from The Telegraph, and Matt Lawless from Express or The Star, one of those.
Yeah.
Like that. Yeah, that'd be pretty cool.
Do you want to hear Miguel's...
Yes, let's move on to some ladies, please.
Okay, so he's got Edvig Lindahl from Sweden in goal. Back three of Lene, Leon and Linari from Italy. Four in midfield. Leupolz from Germany. Rose Lavelle from the US. Losada and Kim Little. And then a very impressive front three of Ludmila from Brazil, Carly Lloyd and Eugénie Le Sommer from France.
Yeah, I somehow figured Carly Lloyd would be in there. All right, you want mine? Here we go.
Yeah, go on.
All right.
I went any with surprises? Any weird stuff?
I don't think they're weird. I think it makes made a lot of sense.
Okay, go on.
All right, so I have Anthony Lopez in goal because, of course, he's French, but not really French and Portuguese. Yeah. He's both, you know, he's everything.
Good choice.
I have Liner at right back from Borussia Mönchengladbach.
Yeah.
Central defense, I was unimaginative. I went with Langlais and Laporte, Renan Lodi at left back.
I love your French side today.
I know, it is very French. Lucas Leiva, of course, double L. How can he not be there? Liverpool legend and Lazio legend. By the way, Liverpool, Lazio, Lucas Leiva. Come on, you know where I'm going with this. Well, Ruben Loftus-Cheek.
What? Quadruple L.
Quadruple L, yeah. Ruben Loftus-Cheek, get well soon, what? RLC.
What? The guy hasn't played since like 2005 or something.
He played an integral part on Chelsea's march to the Europa League, and that was less than a year ago. I got him. And then I have Limer, of course, from Red Bull.
Leipzig. Limer and Liner.
Yes, and Liner used to play for Gladbach. He used to play for Red Bull Salzburg. Yeah. And the other one, you know, just what can I say? All these Teutonic guys are just so unimaginative. Further up the pitch, I've got Romelu Lukaku and Robert Lewandowski.
Okay, so no Italians in your team. No, there's just no Italians in L that you thought could make your team.
No, I had Giovanni Lo Celso, who, of course, I'm sure he's got Italian grandparents,
Because my 11 has only French players, and it would beat the hell out of your team. I've got Hugo Lloris, obviously World Cup champion in goal. I've got.
By the way, I got to dispute Hugo Lloris because his name starts with LL, and as my Spanish, his name is LL. Yes.
But what's the letter? What we're doing the L letter right now.
Okay. So my Spanish speaking purist friends, and please feel free to weigh in on Twitter, say that the LL isn't the letter L. It's an Elie or whatever the hell they call it in Spain. It's a different letter. So take that under advisement. You may need to come up with a different French
in their
goalkeeper.
Alphabet, where is the LL letter?
It's after the letter L.
Yeah, exactly. And what does it start with? L as well, right?
No, but it's LL. It's a different letter.
Okay. So I put Lars Sonner from Brest in goal. Have that. Marcotti.
Which Brest? The Brest in France, right?
Not yeah, the Brest, in
Brest
France.
In, okay.
Yeah. I've got Kenny Lala from Strasbourg at right back. I've got Le Marchand from Fulham at left back. I've got Langlais and Laporte.
Oh, he's really good, isn't he, Le Marchand?
He's good. Wow. He's a lovely guy as well. Langlais and Laporte. Although they're two left-footed, I love them as centre-backs. I've got Pierre Lismelou from Nice as my centre-mid with Léa Siliki from Rennes and Maxime Lopez from Marseille. And then I've got Thomas Lemar playing a number 10 free role everywhere.
Which he does so well.
Up front, obviously, Alexandre Lacazette, my boy Lacazette. And with him, Laborde from Montpellier, the poor man Olivier Giroud.
And the manager, obviously, is Julien Laurens.
Yes, of course.
No surprise there.
No surprise there.
Enough of this nonsense. How about some quick hits instead? We're going to start these quick hits on a melancholy note, as Michael Robinson, one of the most influential figures in Spanish football, has passed away. Jules, your thoughts?
Well, first of all, the player, he had a really good career here in the UK with Brighton and then with Liverpool, where he won the treble and the European Cup and et cetera in that great 80s team with Liverpool. And then he went to Spain, played for Osasuna. And that's the second part of his life, is that he became, and you and I, having moved from our countries to another country, know how hard it is to achieve what he's achieved, but to become, a really amazing host on Spanish television. So now in his own language, really, and a commentator, respected, loved by everyone over there. He was a great man. I only met him very once briefly and sadly in the last game that he actually commentated, which was at Liverpool, in the Liverpool Atletico Madrid, 2 months ago or something in the Champions League. But from what everybody's been saying and the tributes of sport, because he was such a great man.
Yeah, I had the privilege of meeting him more than you did, maybe half a dozen times, and always such a warm person, always so self-deprecating. When he started out in Spain, because obviously Spanish is not his native language, he would make mistakes, but Spanish people found it even more endearing in the way he spoke. And one thing really impressed me, which kind of summed him up, he had this great line. In Spain, he was on a lot of these debates and talk shows like we do in Italy, like we do in England. Spent a lot of time criticizing referees, mistakes, and whatever else. And, he had this great line, which I picked up from a wonderful obituary Sid Lowe wrote about him, which was, "Refereeing errors are the wrinkles on Paul Newman's face, tiny imperfections. They don't change the beauty." And, that to me is purely genius.
That's beautiful. Paulo Dybala, Gab, has reportedly tested positive 4 times for coronavirus. He just can't shake it. And it's been nearly 6 weeks. This is frightening, right? This is really scary.
Yeah. Now, what Juventus are saying is, and just to make it clear, it's not like he had coronavirus, he recovered for it, he got sick again and whatever. No, this is the same case that he's had. He keeps testing positive. It takes a long time to recover and to go beyond the point where you stop testing positive. You can recover physically. Juventus pointed out, for example, that I think, it took Rugani 35 days to finally test negative. It took Blaise Matuidi nearly a month. So, it is worrying. And I think also within the context of players who get sick, recovering, and for them being, you know, safe to play, you know, this guy, it's been what, like 6 weeks now, and he still has the virus in his body. And I think that's something to bear in mind. Very, very sobering thought. But on to happier stuff, Jules, like our old buddy Cesc Fabregas. What's he done for Monaco?
Well, it's interesting. In France, it's like in every country, clubs are trying to get their squads and their players to accept a pay cut. So far, it's been a big failure because no one has accepted a strict direct pay cut. They all have been furloughed, playing staff included. But no one has said, okay, I'm ready to take a 50%, 30%, 20%, 10% pay cut like we've seen in England. But Cesc Fabregas has, on his own, told Monaco that he was ready and happy to take a 30% pay cut, and the guy earns 7.2 million net euros a year.
This is an actual pay cut, right?
Like, so this is a pay cut.
This is not a deferral. This is an actual pay cut.
This bit is a pay cut, so he won't see that money again. He has also told Monaco that he was happy to get 4 month deferral on the rest of his wages. So on top of that, basically, he's not going to be paid for 4 months. And then after that, is 30% less on what Monaco are paying him. And also, and maybe that's the best of the three gestures that he did, really, is that he's told the club that he was going to pay and compensate the money that the staff at the club, so medical staff, technical staff, would be losing because they've been furloughed, and he would compensate and pay the difference with his own money. So great gesture, whether you like him or not, whether you think he's a good person or not. That was great from Cesc Fabregas to do that.
I don't want to count how much money people give up and stuff like that, but I think in Cesc's case, I think I'm going to make an exception, right?
Yeah, definitely. And also,
because just to put this, the guy makes 7.2 million and he's cutting that by 30%. And he's deferring 4 months' wages. That is a huge, huge gesture. And, you know, when people come out and say, oh, look, so-and-so donated 500,000, so-and-so donated 1 million. It's great. All solidarity is great. But, you know, I don't know. I just say hats off. He's a class act. I remember I first met Cesc Fabregas when he was 18 years old, 17. I had lunch with him and Guillaume Balague in Hampstead. And the funny thing is, one of his first appearances for Arsenal, like, I guess he played well or whatever, and people started singing a song about Fabregas, and he was always Cesc. And he's like out there and he's saying, like, why are they singing my dad's name? And he's like, oh, wait a minute. Like, it's a me. Super sweet kid. He was still living in Diggs at the time.
Yeah. But and also, I think his great grandmother, his great grandmother had the virus. She's 95 in Spain, and she beat the virus, which was announced this week as well. So a pretty good week in the Fabregas household.
Tip of the hat to you, Cesc. And if you're listening, come join us on the podcast. I think we're free next week. We'll try to fit you in.
I will ask him for sure. Gab, Gigio Donnarumma's contract expires in the summer of 2021, so only 1 year left. Andre Onana has already said that he wants to leave Ajax, that his time there is over and he wants something new. Will there be a glut of keepers on the market if and when it reopens, do you think? Obviously, Kepa's situation at Chelsea is a bit tricky for him as well.
This is a really interesting one because obviously, you know, Onana is gonna probably come pretty cheap because his contract is winding down. Donnarumma, this is a huge problem for Milan. They're working really hard to see if they can extend it a season. Obviously, it's all made more complicated by the fact that Gigio Donnarumma's agent is who?
Mino!
I'm really fascinated to see how this pans out because if you're Mino Raiola, the standard thing would have been, all right, sit and wait for the contract to run out, and then you can kind of go name your own price. But, Jules, fact of the matter is, most big clubs already have their goalkeeper in place. They're committed to, and they've committed huge amounts of money to him. So I wonder if, in the end, some of these guys might have a rethink. Not Onana, you know, necessarily. But, you know, if I'm Donnarumma, he's making an absurd, absurd amount of money given his age. I think it's round about something like $11 million a year. It's 6.5 million euros net. I mean, which is, you know, he's a tremendous goalkeeper, but that is a ton of money. I think he's I think he's the second or third highest paid goalkeeper in the world. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens. These guys might find they go on the market and there are no takers because clubs simply can't afford them. Now, Watford have just signed Pape Gueye on a free transfer from Le Havre. How excited should they be? And Jules, there's a little backstory to this, isn't there?
Well, there is, and I don't think this the last time we hear about this transfer, and I think there's still a long way before Pape Gueye wears a Watford shirt. But first of all, I have to say huge credit to Watford, to the Pozzo family, to all the scouts and head of recruitment and everything, because once again, they're showing that they're doing a great job.
Pape Gueye going to join his big brother Idrissa at Paris Saint-Germain, right?
his cousin. I mean, PSG were not really that interested, although he was out of contract, so he comes on a free, and he has been, and by far, the best player in France, second division, a bit what N'Golo Kanté was a few years ago when he was in that division with Caen. And Gueye has been very similar. He's young, he's left-footed, he's strong, he's tall, he's so good technically. For me, for any club in England, it was a no-brainer, and a lot of them had tried and made contact. Arsenal, we reported before on the website, but Watford were the first one. They were very, very clever and very quick. However, and this is the little issue, is that the sort of pre-agreement and agreement that Pape Gueye signed with Watford was under his former agent, and the new agent is saying that there was a few issues with that contract. There was a few problems there. Maybe it's not completely legit. Maybe you're right, Gab, it's down to some money or something like that. But it seemed that it could be, I'm just saying it could be, and Watford fans don't at me and Watford people either, but according to the new agent, there could be enough in there for that contract and that signing that has been announced and made official by Watford not actually going through. So it's one we have to keep an eye on, working on it, because it's not the last time I believe we're hearing about it.
More lawyers circling around like vultures.
Yes, indeed. More good news. Manchester United are going to install rail seating, a form of sort of safe standing at Old Trafford for next season. How important is this, Gab?
I think it is important. It's only going to be 1,500 seats, and obviously goodness knows when there's actually going to be real live human beings as fans inside of Old Trafford. But the debate over standing sections in England, it's been ongoing for a long time. Obviously, standing was banned in the top flight following Hillsborough in 1989. I think the view of many has changed since then, that, you know, there is a way to go and stand and have standing sections at football matches, and to do it in a way that's safe. And, you know, let's face it, the atmosphere at Old Trafford, for many different reasons, isn't great. This could be a way to do that. I think they've shown in Germany that you can stand and you can do it safely, and, you know, you can call it rail seating if you want to call it that. But obviously, when done properly, when done respectfully of fans, which is obviously not what happened at Hillsborough, I think it can only add to the excitement and the atmosphere of a game. So let's hope that this works and works well and gets rolled out everywhere. Jules, they're beating drums of war again in the Scottish Premiership over the season ending prematurely and whether to declare a champion. What's going on?
Well, Rangers are not happy, and they say that they want an investigation, that they want to maybe even take the league to court or something if that's the outcome of the season, because they're so close. I mean, they're neck and neck. You said neck to neck?
Neck and neck
with Celtic at the top of – oh, hang on. They're 13 points behind. So maybe they could have won it. Maybe not. I don't know. But they're clearly not happy, which, I mean – I don't know. I know we've said earlier with France that you need to look after your club's interest and fight for your corner and this and that. I think there's times where, you know, you have to be sensible as well, right?
Yeah, I don't want to reduce this all to money. I guess the main implication of finishing second rather than first or whatever might have to do with Champions League places and direct qualification or whatever. I just find this incredibly stupid. I don't think that to go and make this a matter of principle one way or another. The clubs voted on it in Scotland, as I understand.
Yeah.
They voted a certain way and just live with it. You know, go worry about other things. I mean, that's just my take. But the problem in Scotland, of course, is that this has been age old and I really don't want to get into it. And yeah, don't at me either, please, Celtic and Rangers fans, is that you've got this tremendous all-encompassing rivalry, which is always there. It's part of what makes it great, but also has this dark side with these two clubs continually maneuvering against each other.
Mauricio Pochettino says that he dreams of once again managing Spurs one day. Do we take this seriously, Gav? I mean, come on. He was not going to say like, oh, no, you know, I'm not going to come back and like thrash it all, right?
No, he spent a long time at Tottenham. It's a long time in a manager's life. And obviously he's going to come out and say something like that. He's not trying to undermine you, Jose Mourinho, and your paranoia. Focus instead on delivering your food parcels. Like, it is what it is, right? He's out there. He wants his name to be out there. He knows that he and Allegri are a commodity. He's been linked to the Newcastle job. Surprise, surprise. But I think he's genuine when he says he wants to be back one day. Whether that'll happen, I don't know. Maybe 10 years down the line. I'm assuming, shouldn't he be linked more often with Paris Saint-Germain?
Why? We're very happy with our manager. What's the problem?
Well, I know, but he's a former PSG legend. Yeah. Come on, man.
I think without being linked heavily in the papers or, you know, in media and stuff, I think he's definitely on the short list somewhere if the club decides to let Tuchel go. The only problem is Leonardo being the sporting director, and of all the managers who are available, there's obviously one that is closer to than others, and that one is not Pochettino. It's more someone that comes from your country with initials M and A.
Oh, yes. Supermax.
Supermax, of course.
Wouldn't be the Gab and Jules show without an Mbappe update. Go for it, Jules.
Okay, so he posted a message on social media yesterday. Let's look at it in a normal way, not mischievous, where he says, everyone's talking, but no one knows. I miss my team, which is everyone is talking about when can we start football again? When can we play? But no one actually really knows when that's possible. And he really misses his team. I think that's the normal way to read it. Now, if we're a bit mischievous, it's like, oh, everybody's talking about me and my future, but no one knows. I miss my team because I want to stay where I am. I'm so happy in Paris. I will stay here forever, all my life.
Killian, are they all talking? Because I'm sorry, I don't live in the French football bubble, but the guy that everybody's talking about his future is actually Neymar, isn't it? It's not the daily drip from Barcelona, Neymar this, Neymar that, blah, blah, blah.
But the daily drip from Real Madrid is on Mbappe is very much there too. You know that.
But they already have a very handsome French center forward. Why do they need another one?
Because the one they already have will be 33 in December. That's why. Well, and finally, Gab, you recently sat down with Roma boss Paolo Fonseca. What did he have to say?
Well, you'll have to wait and read the piece. It's going to be up, I think, in the next days on the website. But it's always fun to talk to him because you know how a lot of managers do not like talking tactics and do not like talking football and how they, you know, they don't get granular. They say like, yeah, we work hard, we motivate, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, so important. But no, this dude comes out. He talked about tactical innovations he's seen in the game, how the game of football is changing. He talked about stuff that excites him. He's just one of the most pleasant and enthusiastic football guys to chat to who, you know, who doesn't go around saying, oh, look, I have all these tactical secrets. I'm not going to share them with you. I'm just speaking cliches. No, he's kind of like the opposite of Bill Belichick. He's far better dressed than Bill Belichick. He's far more handsome than Bill Belichick.
Does he have a dog as well or no?
What? A dog named Tom? No, I don't think so. But, you know, and he doesn't deflate. But no, I stop that. Stop that. Sorry, Patriots. We can't be.
That's your hatred for the Patriots. But, just coming back quickly.
It's respect, man. You,
but Fonseca doing a great job at Roma. I mean, they had a tough February, right? They lost like three or four games.
Tremendous amount of injuries this year. Absurd amount of injuries. But talked about Chris Smalling and how much he wants to keep him. And Zaniolo, his hopes for him. I thought it was an entertaining interview. Hopefully you will too when you read it. All right, let's leave it there. Let's hope to come back on Monday, shall we?
Let's go. Let's aim for Monday. Everyone have a safe weekend, a good weekend. We will obviously do your letter on Monday. The letter M for your team. So send us your team. You could have Marc Coutier as a number 10, as a goalkeeper, his favorite position, or as a manager.
No, I don't play. I was more of a defensive midfielder in the Dino, or center back in the Dino Baggio style. I'll have
I like that.
Yes, if I were playing today, I would model myself after your boy Etienne Capoue, I think.
Oh, nice.
That would be the goal. Yeah. All right, but we'll be back on Monday.
Yeah, let's go. Stay safe, people.